Hello and welcome to Ask the Mayor on WFIU. I'm Joe Wren from WFIU, WTIU News. This week, it's the first week of the month. And as always, I'm joined by Columbus Mayor Jim Lineup. Hello and welcome.
Welcome, Joe. Good to be here.
Well, I think everyone is kind of talking about and wanting to know about this winter storm that's approaching. Of course, it's changing. Yesterday, we were talking about it would be 4 inches in the Bloomington, Columbus area. Now I'm hearing maybe up to 7 inches, but I think it's still early. What are you hearing? And is the city preparing for the winter storm?
Well, there's plenty of jokes in there about weathermen, you know, and the accuracy of their forecasts. And so we're sort of seeing them hedge themselves all across the board. But right now, what we're expecting or what we're being told to expect, or I met this morning with our Department of Public Works, rain on Wednesday, and then over the night, temperatures will drop and that'll convert to sleet and then to ice and then to snow. And so we'll just have to wait and see in terms of the volume, you know, how much we get of all that. We've seen or heard 3 inches to 12 inches. So again, the numbers, and the activity bounces around a little bit, but the bottom line is that our DPW folks are, you know, prepared. I mean, they've identified a number of contingencies. They've identified the people who would act or react as drivers. And it not only includes folks in the Department of Public Works, but some utilities, crews, and Parks Department crews. I mean, if the snow gets big enough, it's not adequate to just push it to the side. You know, we've got to get some front end loaders out there and actually pick up snow and take it down to the White River and dump it in there. But we've identified the crews that will be assigned, and they've all been put on notice that they are on call all weekend. So everybody's watching just to see what happens. And we'll react is the, I guess, appropriate word to whatever conditions come about. It'll be difficult for us because we can't prepare. I mean, you can't put any kind of product down in advance of the storm because it would all be washed away, or if covered with ice, sometimes we have to scrape the ice and that moves the product to the side of the road as well. So it'll be a little bit of a challenge, but our guys are prepped and ready to go. And they told me too, we got 900 tons of salt and we've got 700 tons on order, but you know, the demand is pretty consistent across the Midwest and particularly out east, you know. So, you know, we're trying to get that stuff delivered, and it's a challenge, you know. But I think 900 tons to get us through this weekend, and then we'll see what happens.
Is that I was going to ask about that. Is that just a salt, or is it a mixture of brine? And it's like every city or county uses sand or something different.
Yeah. Yeah, we do not use sand. We're concerned that it'll fill up the wastewater, stormwater drains, and so we don't use any sand in our mix. The county, Bartholomew County, used to use sand, but I've heard that they're not going to do that this year. Just use the salt. The brine works well when you can get it down at the appropriate time, but I don't think that's on the agenda for this storm.
Quick update on, you know, COVID numbers have seemed to plateau and maybe a slight decrease in some areas, but, you know, good news, although we're still talking that we're at that kind of all-time high, right. Maybe, I don't know, seeing some post-holiday numbers now coming down. Just any more information, any new data that you're getting, any more vaccination clinics or testing clinics maybe that are open that people should know about?
No, we're trying to do what we can to open up the avenue for testing. It seems like we've got a lot of people who get the sniffles and, you know, they want to check to see if they've got COVID. And I appreciate that because it means that they've got some care and concern, not just for them, but for the people around them. And that's something we've been preaching since this started. But the numbers that we're seeing, as you sort of alluded to, they tend to bear out what we had been told early on, which is that with respect to Omicron, we would see a spike, a sudden, you know, ramp up of infections and hospitalizations. And we saw that. And so what we're hoping to see is what they've seen in the UK and some other countries where, you know, following the spike is a quick plateau and then, you know, a precipitous drop. And so we're hopeful that, you know, that that leads us to, you know, the same result. But we're just cautiously optimistic at this time. I really feel badly for the healthcare professionals, you know, in our community. I think that they're being asked to do a significant amount of work. And I know it's been taxing and challenging for them. So appreciate it. I hope they understand how truly appreciated they are by those of us who are, you know, watching what they're doing and encouraging, you know, everybody else to get masked and vaccinated, even though sometimes that falls on deaf ears. I think we're one of somewhere in Bartholomew County, somewhere around 58% of the eligible people are vaxxed, but we need to do better. But it, sooner or later, it's going to wash through here, and we'll be moving on. But my sense is we'll be moving on. We'll be moving on with an increased realization of how difficult a disease this can be, and what it can do to you as an individual, and by extension to the family and friends that you've got around. So, not unlike influenza, not unlike some of the other childhood diseases that we're familiar with. I think we're going to live with this for a while, and hopefully, people will, you know, change their attitudes with respect to vaccinations.
Any update or been able to spend the American Relief Plan funds, or any direction given on how to start allocating that?
I don't think we've got any update. We announced a few weeks ago what the city had planned to do with the dollars allocated to it. Just don't have that handy. But we have taken a look at that. There was an article in the paper today about what the county has spent, and we're on a little bit different track. Part of what we've been advised to do is to hang on to some of the money in anticipation that there may be another twist in the road, you know, coming up. And so we've announced our plans, and nothing new, you know, on that.
You know, we've been reporting the final group of Afghan evacuees have left Camp Atterbury. Just from your perspective and what you've heard, I know you're Columbus, the city is pretty close down the road there at I-65. What have you heard anything about how that process went, how the state handled that, and then how much Columbus and the city got involved?
Well, the city of Columbus really didn't get involved at all. I mean, for us, it was kind of or almost a non-event. And that really isn't where we had expected it to go. We expected to be involved. We expected to be asked to help, you know, participate in the not necessarily the welcoming, but the integration of these people into our society here in the United States. And that ask never came. Now, there were a few churches here in town that reached out and adopted a couple families, if that's the right word. And I understand that that's moving forward. And these are folks who already have some level of English proficiency and needed a little bit of help in terms of trying to figure out how to navigate life in Columbus, Indiana. But in terms of the effect on our community, it really was pretty minimal. You know, we didn't get much in the way of impact or reports, you know, what was going on at Atterbury. And so the fact that it came and it went, you know, without a lot of dislocation for among locals, I think is something that we can be very pleased about. The people who I did have a chance to interact with, some of the Army personnel that are stationed up there, I mean, these are very capable people. And, you know, they were given a rather difficult task at almost the last minute. And it just sort of showed, you know, how capable they are. You know, they were able to arrange for housing and to arrange for medical care and food and whatnot. And, you know, got those people processed and relocated, you know, throughout the country.
Any indication about how many were able to find work and housing there in Columbus?
No, I was told three families. So I couldn't tell you whether that's 12 people or 20 or three. You know, I don't know.
You know, I'm anxious to hear more on what you know about last time. You did a really good job of explaining the business personal property tax cuts that were being proposed at the Indiana General Assembly. And I asked Terre Haute Mayor Duke Bennett and Bloomington's John Hamilton the same. And I don't know, you guys are all on board on those cuts with no replacement funds. So it's been a month since we talked. And I know the House bill passed, but has anything else changed?
Not that I know of. I mean, I think there were a few minor tweaks to the House bill, but my understanding is that in the Senate, there's a little bit more of a, I would, from my perspective as a mayor, I'll say correct understanding, but you know, everybody's got their own perspective, but at least an understanding that the rug you pull out from under ought not be somebody else's, somebody else is standing on. And so that notion is kind of welcome here. You know, we've been told, and I don't know how accurate this information is, but it would cost the Bartholomew County taxing entity several million dollars if that went away. And so if the change went, if the 30% that's being discussed went to zero. And again, that's a really difficult number to model. I mean, I spent a career, you know, in the tax area, and I've seen it from the taxpayer side, and it's a difficult tax to administer. I must admit that. And from a practitioner's perspective, it would make sense for it to go away, but we just can't end it in 1 year. I mean, that would be a severe dislocation, not only to the city, but the county, the schools, the library, you know, any place that receives tax receipts from the tax on business personal property. We've got a TIF district that is funded entirely by business personal property tax. And so, you know, there, none of those questions were answered with respect to, well, what do we do? You know, how do we manage, you know, what you've left us? And so with what I guess I've learned is that it looks like some cooler heads are going to prevail in the Senate, and we'll just have to wait and see how that all turns out.
You know, I was talking with municipal consultant Dax Norton in Nashville, and he was more concerned about a Senate bill that would about food and it's the food and beverage tax, and about them sunsetting that tax after 20 years. And he, of course, Nashville, Brown County is heavily, gets a lot of their money through tourism. And I would assume Columbus the same. Have you looked into that at all?
No, I really haven't followed that. So we don't have a food and beverage tax. And so for us, it's a little bit out of sight, out of mind. But in general, I mean, that's, you get that notion from time to time at the General Assembly, which is that, you know, the people who live in a particular area may have made a decision that they deem is in their best interests. And, you know, here comes somebody from the General Assembly who, you know, deems it not to be in their best interest. And so, you know, they think they can override, and they can. I mean, it's certainly within their realm of opportunity and authority. But to sunset a tax like that after 20 years is, it doesn't make much common sense to me. I mean, if the voters in a particular area want that tax to go away, all they have to do is elect people who will make that tax go away. I mean, they don't need a directive from on high. At the same time, you know, that particular tax kind of makes some sense. I mean, again, we've not pursued it here in Bartholomew County, but I would tell you it's a bit of an elective tax. It's only charged on prepared foods. And so if you don't eat prepared foods, you know, if you buy your foods at the grocery store and fix them yourself, prepare them yourself, well, you don't pay the tax. So to a certain extent, there is an element that that most people appreciate, which is that I can choose to pay it or not. It's generally a small tax, a point, a percentage. You know, so if you've got a $5 meal at a fast food restaurant, it's a nickel. And again, so it's a tax that not a lot of people will even notice. Not to say that makes it right. I mean, it's just saying that you notice your property taxes on your house. Okay, you notice your income taxes that come taken out of your paycheck. This one is pretty, it's much less consequential. And a good portion of it, as we anticipate, is paid by people who don't live here. You know, people who are visiting and passing through, and therefore they are able to finance some of the improvements that tax pays for. And so there's a variety of arguments in favor of it. That's why you've got several of them around the state. But just to pick a number out of the sky and say it's going to go away after 20 years is, a little hard to understand.
I guess you can kind of say the same about the innkeeper's tax.
Right. Yeah, we do have an innkeeper's tax. And it funds you know, activities related to visitors. And again, it's not paid generally by the people who live here. It's paid by people who visit here. And it's selective. I mean, you don't, I would never want to admit this out loud, but you don't have to stay in Bartholomew County, right? I mean, if that's a problem, maybe there's a county that does not charge that, although I'm pretty confident there are very few. But likewise, I mean, we use that to fund certain activities, and it's really hard for me to think that we're going to go tell the visitor center that they've got to cease operation after 20 years. I mean, it just doesn't make sense.
And I know, looking ahead to the conference center that you're planning on building, is that part of the funding coming from the innkeeper's tax?
No. That'll be funded, by the property taxes that are generated by the facility.
And from what I understand, that all is starting to come together. We're very early in that, but the court services building, also known as the probation department, has a opening coming up soon, and that frees up space for the new conference center. Is that right?
Right. Yeah. The dominoes are starting to fall, in terms of our downtown development. You're right. We have a building under construction right now that is south of the jail, and it will house the court services department, or we commonly refer to it as the probation department. That activity, probation department, is currently occupying a building at 3rd and Lafayette. So when we move into, or when the probation department moves into the new building, which we expect sometime around May 1st, then we will move to demolish the old building at the corner of 3rd and Lafayette. We anticipate being able to move on a hotel, conference center, and parking garage on that block sometime this year. But it's still kind of hung up in the COVID fog. Business travel is still a little bit of an unknown, and we expect business travel to be a big proponent or big portion of what goes on in that facility. So it may take us a while yet to unravel all that and figure out what the new economic modeling looks like. So we will, we do have the money, and we will tear down the old building. If without a tenant and without any occupancy, it doesn't really make a lot of sense to keep it there. It becomes more of an eyesore than any kind of an asset. So we will we'll move to do that. And if nothing else, we'll just let people park on that for a while.
Now, speaking again of the conference center, can you kind of go by what other tourism and hotels, and maybe even, of course, the Commons, which is a huge facility there in downtown Columbus, the effect or use of that, and how that can maybe compare to what a conference center could do?
Well, I'm not, it's maybe a tough question to answer, but what we've done is, talk to some people who are in that business. There's consultants as well as developers. And then you also talk to the folks at Marriott and Hilton. I mean, they obviously, understand what the various needs are. And from that, you estimate the number of keys or rooms, that you have. And I want to say we were somewhere around 250, which is a pretty good sized place. A lot of the places you see out at the interstate, can be 100, plus or minus in terms of rooms. But they also estimate for us based upon the activities that we used to have with the Clarion and just sort of what they know, in terms of how they assess the local business travel climate. What size ballroom we ought to have. And I want to say we were focused on 9,000 square feet, which will adequately handle 600. Round tables with, I want to say 8 seats a table, could be 10, but at any rate, so everything is sort of sized, to kind of sort of fit together. There were 4 breakout rooms, and I'm drawing a blank on the size of those rooms, but, the opportunity was to provide for, smaller meeting spaces. And like I say, for breakouts, if a group wanted to do that. So basically what you're talking about in general is a regional type conference, which is distinguishable, as I've learned, from a convention or an event. So the Commons that we have here in Columbus is suitable for an event. There's really only one activity that you can do at a time. It's all got to be in that one big room. You can sort of break up into, subgroups, but you're in the one, you're still in the same room. You haven't been able to gain any advantage by trying to cloister up in an individual room. at a convention, you may have multiple activities underway at the same time. You know, you could have two or three groups there all meeting and, never the twain shall meet kind of a thing. At a conference center where we will be, we would expect to have a larger group, in many cases, a regional one. The Clarion was a good draw for groups across the state of Indiana. Columbus is not in the middle of the state like Indianapolis, but we're close to it. And we've got a few amenities here that people enjoy. I mean, not just the architecture, but some of the commons or the playground associated with it, Zaharico's, those were always things that people enjoyed visiting. So we were able to draw those kind of crowds. And we'd like to get back into that business, but nonetheless, we sort of got to get through where we started the conversation, which is the Omicron variant on this pandemic, and get a feel for what level of business travel we can anticipate. And then from that, make some decisions about how you size the hotel, how you size the conference center, and then of course, how you pay for it.
We just have a couple of minutes left. I just wanted to give you an opportunity to give us an update on, I know there's a lot going on with the urban grocer and apartments downtown, and of course, Nexus Park, that we've gotten a couple emails from viewers and listeners as well.
Yeah, the dominoes, as I mentioned, downtown here have begun to topple over, or at least to wiggle. And the apartment and urban grocer is one of those along that line. On the 26th of January, which is, one day last week, we were able to close on the transfer of the land to the developer, Flaherty and Collins, and we were able to close on some bonds that were needed to help fund the construction of what will go on there. They will begin here within about a month. They're going to move, I don't know if it was 60 tons or 60 trucks. The numbers tend to run together, but we're going to bring in a lot of fill dirt. There are some low places in that on that site. That will all begin here, as I said, around March 1st, maybe a little bit later. They'll start construction. We will get somewhere around 200 apartments in that facility, along with a small grocery store. And when I say small, I mean I'm talking 12 to 15,000 square feet. So we don't know yet who the operator will be. That's Flaherty and Collins. They're going to be the landlord, so it's a bit of who they decide to lease to. We're anticipating being able to see more yellow equipment than not just on the court services building site, but over there at the apartment urban grocer. And then we'll follow along pretty shortly after that with what we call the 1821 Trail, which is a legacy project for the bicentennial that we had, but really is just a rebuild of First Street from this site on Lafayette Street west towards the railroad track and down at Water Street. You mentioned Nexus Park, and yes, we're moving forward there as well. We have got several public meetings lined up that will start, February 15th and go on out from there. We have retained the drawings, we've got conceptual drawings. There's a certain lingo that goes with this, and I sometimes get turned around with it, but we have the conceptual drawings this morning at the Board of Public Works. We approved to issue a request for qualifications. This will go to companies that may be interested in a design and build contract. And once we get responses to the RFQ, we'll evaluate those, and those responders who are deemed to be capable, and for lack of a better word, they'll be asked to bid on the design and build process that will build the field house and do some interior renovations there at the mall. So we're moving forward. If you want to look at it in terms of dominoes, we'll begin to see some of those drop in 2 weeks on the 15th.
All right. The time always goes by so fast. So much going on in Columbus. Really appreciate your time and hope to see you again next month.
Thank you. Take care.
And those listening, don't forget, you can submit your question to news@indianapublicmedia.org or join us on Twitter, Ask the Mayor. See you next month. Bye-bye.